Hello, welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast. I'm your host, Ian T.D. Thompson. The Positive Energy Podcast is the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. The initiative seeks to strengthen public confidence in Canadian energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. Today on the program, we are continuing our discussion with Positive Energy faculty affiliates, Professor Stephen Burt of Clarkson University and Professor Eric LaChapelle of the Université de Montréal on Positive Energy's recently published survey report. Please visit the Positive Energy website to listen to part one of this discussion. I hope you enjoy. Stephen, you mentioned one of the findings, and I found this to be particularly interesting because it's a bit of an area that has been getting more, that has been discussed more frequently over time. And this is that idea for support for dual action between the oil sands development and achieving climate commitments. And it was interesting just to see that there was consensus among even across age generations for that idea, for moderate support of dual action. Stephen, could you be able to talk a little bit more about this finding and what this might mean for Canada's energy future?
Yeah, so this actually was one of the more surprising findings for me personally. So we find net support overall at plus 11, and there's a pretty clear, when you take a look at the slide of the data, which are available online, you can really see this clear consensus emerging amongst people that we should be able to do both. And our question wording was to be able to develop fossil fuels such as oil sands in Alberta and still meet climate commitments. And so it's quite specific in nature. And so Canadians think there should be a path. And I think right now the challenge to decision makers is to be able to delineate what that path looks like. And that is a real challenge. And that's also, I think, to come back to Eric's points concerning national government, this is where either a role of some agreement, broad agreement amongst premiers or the national government is demonstrating what the path needs to look like forward. I think oftentimes provinces are played off each other in the dialogue in the media and also sometimes amongst provincial premiers. But I think the hope and the expectation of the Canadian public is to sort of lay out what this plan looks like and does so in a reasonable manner and does so with effective policies that address carbon and also think about how to allow for continued development of something like the oil sands. It's a challenge, not an easy. I think what people want is something that's actually very hard to do in reality, to have effective climate commitments and still be able to do that. Possible perhaps, but with lots of need for clear policies and thinking about technological change and a whole host of other issues. So it's a challenge, but the expectation is there.
Yeah, as you said, the expectation is there, there's support there. Now it's just a matter of decision makers being able to sit down and figure out how do we get from point A to point B. I'm just curious from my own perspective here, are there any jurisdictions we can look at? I believe your slide deck specified or just gave the example of Norway as a specific jurisdiction where it's a oil-driven economy in Norway, yet they seem to be still undergoing similar climate objectives as Canada. Are we able to take anything away from them as a jurisdiction and how we can apply it to our massive country in comparison?
So it's interesting. Norway is sort of the poster child for a large-scale fossil fuel dependent nation, right? Large scale development in primarily offshore, and also one of the most aggressive nations in the world for decarbonization. I think what they have essentially done is focus a large amount of the revenues in the form of taxation and developing a large scale pension plan. And that's been in play for decades. We haven't done that in Canada. But the challenge, if we think about Norway as an example, is that Norway is small. It is regionally similar. It doesn't have the large scale jurisdictional differences. It's not federalist in nature. It has a different constitution. So their policies have clearly shown the way to sort of do both things at once. But their institutional constraints and sort of the underlying constraints of the nature of what that country is, small, one essential area to deal with, are very different from Canada's. So there are example, but it's also perhaps not fully comparable to Canada.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge there.
It's always a thing in public policy where we look at what the Scandinavian countries are doing and just seeing the success of their outcomes, but it's never quite one-to-one in being able to apply those policies. And I guess the same goes here for climate change. I just want to continue talking a little bit about the results. And we're talking about a little bit more, not just about polarization, but as well as where there is consensus. And one of the topics that you talked about was this idea of the speed and the nature of the energy transition, moving away from fossil fuel energy to more renewable technology, renewable energy, and where participant support kind of landed in regards to having either an aggressive or a balanced transition. Would you be able to describe a little bit about what those two transitions look like and where was the public preference on either of these transitions?
So I was really excited about this question. And then Eric added on the idea, oh, let's take a look at what people think aggressive is versus what a balanced approach is. So we asked them first, you know, do you want an aggressive transition or do you want a balanced transition? And then after they told us that, we asked them what that actually meant in terms of years. 5 years, is it 10 years? Is it 50 years? Is it 100 years? And so what's interesting is quite clearly the aggressive people are more aggressive, but they're not that much more aggressive than the balanced people. And overall, there's a clear consensus. The expectation is that we're going to need to transition our energy system in some way, shape, or form, or decarbonize it to some degree, in the next 10 to 25 years, with the aggressive folks focused more on the next 10 to 15 years on average, and the balanced folks with an expectation for more of a closer to a 25-year trajectory. And so there's, again, a clear expectation being developed here with obviously a little bit more aggressive approach from those folks that want that. But the differences were not that big, and there was a fairly clear consensus in and around that 25-year mark. So again, this is an area that's not polarized and an area where people have clear expectations about what they want from their federal and their provincial governments.
That's so fascinating because when you just think of it like linguistically, you know, what aggressive means, the harshness of it versus a balanced approach. Yet at the same time, there's a little bit more commonality when we actually say, how do you define these two types of transitions? I think that's really cool. So this survey work looked at tried to break down public opinion based on a number of different unique groupings. And one was age. And it was interesting to see a little bit of the generational divide across several of the policy topics, not all the policy topics. But for instance, millennials support a carbon tax. And with baby boomers, the opposite is true. They don't support a carbon tax. Stephen, would you be able to explain a little bit about how is energy policy exposing these differences across the generations?
Yeah, sure. So I think I have a relatively simplistic answer for this question. I think millennials and Gen Z feel more threatened by climate change, and so they're looking for more aggressive solutions to that problem, whereas folks that are older see it as less of an imminent threat. But I think one of the interesting areas here, I would not characterize the differences between the age cohorts as polarized. I would say it's a bit more closer to fragmented overall. The differences are not super stark. They're more stark in a couple of other areas that were surprising. So that's my simple explanation to that. But I don't know, Eric, if you have more that you would add to that.
Yeah, a couple things. I want to just circle back really quickly because I have to say this about the Norway comparison. Norway also has a nationalized oil and gas sector, and they have a sovereign wealth fund. And we tried that in the 1980s, and it didn't work out so well. So, I mean, the comparison with Norway is quite limited. Also, when you look at that commitments question, the dual action question, I mean, it's an open question as to whether people understand what Canada's climate commitments are and how aggressive those are. I think we need to be careful before drawing these inferences and saying Canadians, they think it's possible to square this circle between oil sands development and climate commitments, when in fact they might not be completely aware of what those climate commitments are and how far we are from obtaining those. So I just wanted to just point out those two things.
That's a really important point.
Yeah.
That's great, Eric. Thanks.
Yeah, no problem. The transition stuff, I think, was really good. And I like how you brought up, Ian, the word, like the linguistic difference between balanced and aggressive and how that changes. I like the way you framed that, actually. That might actually be something we might want to pursue in our analysis, how that difference is reduced when you look at actual timing. What does this mean versus what do the words mean to you? So I like that. Now, on the age and the general divide, I tend to agree with Stephen. Mm-hmm. I think that, and it kind of circles back to my answer regarding the normalization, I guess, of the carbon tax. We've been talking about carbon pricing for quite a few years now. British Columbia has, you know, a long-standing carbon tax going on 10 years. Quebec, too, with the carbon market in California. And, you know, the federal government implemented a carbon tax and got reelected. So, I mean, to some extent, there's something going on in this country that the unachievable seems to have been achieved, at least to some extent. And the example you cited was great, the Alberta example. There's no need now to implement part of the federal carbon tax policy because Kenny did it for the federal government, right? So I think that, you know, we really need to. So this idea of normalization, I think, plays in the idea that the youth really know that this is an issue. They have greater stakes in this issue than anyone else because they're going to be alive when a lot of these invisible costs that Stephen was talking about materialize. And so I think that there's the interesting thing to look at in that particular graphic is not that there's just as much support amongst other generations for a carbon tax as millennials. What's interesting is when you look at the opposition, there's less strong opposition amongst millennials, right? And I think that, to me, is the crucial element to tease out here. Whereas a carbon tax evokes strong opinions across older generations, when it comes to the youth, it's less likely to evoke intense opposition because these people know that, yeah, you know, there's going to be some pay now or pay later, essentially. And I think the kids get that, the youth get that. And that's why they're more willing to, I don't want to, it would be wrong to say that there's more support amongst millennials for a carbon tax. But I think it's correct to say that there's less opposition amongst millennials and less strong opposition amongst millennials for a carbon tax. And I think this is where, I think Stephen's explanation gives us a good beginnings of an answer as to why that's the case.
Just continuing on, this was briefly mentioned a little bit earlier on in the interview. And when we're talking more about polarization, the key one here is this idea of political parties. And there does seem to be a little bit of that polarization existing when subjects are broken down vis-a-vis political parties. And I always think of this idea that one could probably guess a subject's opinion on energy policies based on their political affiliation. And of course, we have now this outcome seen in the 2019 federal election, a little bit of a regional split in the country based on political affiliation. We have the East-West sort of split. You could say West going to the Conservative Party, East parties as well as areas in BC going to the Liberals. A little bit of a generalization there, but a little bit of that East split is what I'm trying to get at here. But I'm just curious, how should we observe the findings in terms of these two elements, the regional divide as well as the political party divide, especially in terms of what we saw in October?
I think what one of the ways to look at this is there seems to be quite a bit of congruence with what we found and with the electoral result in terms of the political and the regional opinion differences that we observe in our data. They also seem to be observable in the electoral result of 2019. And I think, again, this suggests that our data has a high external validity because our data we were in field during the election campaign. And so to the extent that there were differences in opinion on these issues at that particular time, we were able to pick them up in our survey. And I think that that's an important point to make, is that we have an externally validated result with the election that kind of speaks to the validity of our data. At the same time, we've been talking about to what extent our opinions polarize, and we said, you know, there is evidence of a polarized public, but there's also evidence of less polarization than we might assume, or there's areas of agreement. And I think that's crucial to keep in mind right now, in the sense that to the extent that we find a lot of people in the middle or with more malleable opinions, less hardened opinions. I think that despite the election outcome that we have and this view that, oh my God, the country's divided and we're not going to be able to get anything done, I think our data actually have something to say to that more pessimistic view where we might be able to find some opportunities here to kind of forge some coalitions going forward.
Stephen, is there anything you'd like to add regarding that idea of there is aspects of support that decision makers might be able to take from your work?
Yeah, so just to quickly expand on that, the one observation I make, even in areas where we see the most polarization, so something like carbon tax, and then if you take a look at it at party breakdown, it's not surprising, right, that the Conservative Party shows high opposition to carbon tax, and the Liberal Party and the Bloc Québécois and the NDP and the Greens have much higher. But what, so that's, and that's a polarized issue. But even there, there's an awful lot of opinion in the middle on this party identifying question for any one of these parties. And I think then when you move to other kinds of questions about the support for pipelines or about transition or fossil fuels and climate or nuclear support, you'll see that party differentiation. And it's one of the strongest explainers, I guess, of our work. But at the same time, there's a big range across most of the parties with variations in ways that you would typically expect, even when the issues are fairly polarized. And when they're more fragmented, then you see that range much more evenly distributed across parties. So it's not the case that a party's stance on any one of these given energy or environmental or climate change issues is the driver of the way people think and their affiliation with any given party.
Mm-hmm. So I'm hearing that there is some silver linings in all of this, that there is some consensus. There's something that decision makers might be able to pull from this in terms of how they craft energy and climate policy decisions. I was hoping either of you, if you could jump in regarding that question of how should decision makers in the federal government use this information? People want more support of the national government to be involved with these decisions. What are they able to pull from this, from your survey work, for their own decisions?
Interesting. I have to think about that. I think really one of the challenges for political decision makers and leaders is in developing a policy that really convinces people they're addressing the concerns and interests of their given region. I don't think, frankly, any of the parties have been successful in doing that in any kind of a comprehensive way. So even if the Liberal Party is making an argument that they're trying to advance the interests of people who are in the prairies, it's pretty clear that folks who live there are not fully convinced. So I think part of the issue is outlining or delineating a policy that attempts to address the way people feel on many of these issues, and then secondarily, to do it in a way that seems credible. And I think part of the challenge may be something that is captured only in, as a side note in our work, which is the concern for credibility amongst decision makers and elite. My first strike at that, there might be more I want to add, but I'm not sure. And Eric, I invite you to add more if you wish.
Yeah, so I would add two things. The first is that looking at those regional breakdowns, even where you see a polarized public by region, you clearly see that regions within a region, public opinion is not homogenous, right? There's actually quite a bit of heterogeneity in the regions. Some other work I've done has shown that values are more important explanatory factors for policy issues than regions, and that there are different value clusters and different value characteristics within regions. So you're going to get, you know, Quebec is dominated by egalitarians, but that does not mean that there are not egalitarians in Alberta. You actually have quite a few egalitarians in Alberta. It's just the case that they are less prominent than they are in Quebec. So I think with the view of regions are not monolithic, I think what policymakers can do is kind of have a, like Stephen was talking about, making sure that people feel that the regional interests are respected, community interests are respected, but also looking for coalitional partners within regions that have kind of similar policy views or similar views on these issues, I think is possible. And I think is something that, so rather than paint a picture of different regions in different colors, look for the different colors within the regions to assemble a cross-national coalition in support of a particular policy proposal. I think that, to me, is a key take-home, not to treat regions as monolithic. And the second thing I would add is that this is just one poll, and it should not be treated as an end in itself. This is not an end. This is just the beginning. It's a starting point. And I think that, too, we need to consider that. I think it's super useful at this particular point in time in terms of thinking about what might be possible in this country, but it's not necessarily static. And so this is going to evolve, and it's going to take some political leadership and some entrepreneurship to put these coalitions together to get the kinds of policies we need in this country to address the challenges that we're facing.
We're easing in nicely into this idea of the future of this work. You mentioned that we shouldn't be looking at this as kind of a standalone thing, that there's more to kind of build up on this work. And the slide deck that I have, it mentions this other caveat of the research, that we're just observing the quote-unquote simple cuts with the survey analysis. Eric, continuing on with this point, we talk about the two caveats. One is the election. The other is the fact that these are the simple cuts. Eric, what further analysis will be conducted with this survey work?
So the obvious one is we're going to want to look more. So we've done basically bivariate, looked at the bivariate relationships between something like age and opinion on a carbon tax. So we're very much looking at the demographic views across different demographics. And that's interesting, but it's also limited because there might be some spurious correlations. I mentioned just previously how regions might actually be less important in explaining policy preferences than values. So the next step is to do multivariate analyses in which we're going to be definitely controlling for things like gender, generational cohort, and that sort of a thing. But we're going to be looking more specifically at things like climate change attitudes and values and traditional left-right ideology. So to what extent are these issues traditional left-right issues, or to what extent are new value cleavages more, to what extent do new value cleavages offer us more, relatively more explanatory power when trying to predict public attitudes towards these controversial and contested issues? So that, to me, is part of the next step.
Mm-hmm. That's quite interesting. One of the next steps also in this is kind of getting a little bit more into the drivers of polarization. And Eric, you kind of touched a little bit about that. But Stephen, I was wondering if you'd be able to tell us a little bit more about these elements, if there's anything you'd like to add regarding that, regarding polarization drivers or next steps.
Yep. So we really see this work as a start. So one is to take, there's additional parts of the data in the survey that we haven't yet explored because it takes a long time to develop it and clean the data and then run the analyses. But we'll be doing more of this multivariate work and incorporating additional factors into the analysis that are not there yet. So that's critically important. The other thing is, as Eric mentioned earlier, this particular survey is just a snapshot. And what we're hoping to do is to do this as an ongoing work so that we can see, so we can more closely or carefully examine polarization as opposed to just a snapshot of how and whether people are polarized in certain ways, shapes, or forms. So our ongoing work will take a look at this as a process over time, which I think is a real improvement. And we may be tweaking some of our questions and or taking a look at if there's anything that we feel that we're missing. So we're really excited about this as the beginning of a certain kind of survey work that helps to analyze why and how people are getting to where they are, whether they're polarized, whether they're fragmented, or whether they're in agreement, and to try to look at this as comprehensively as possible. So that's where we're going with this, and that's across the Canadian energy and environmental spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And let me just say that I think it's a really terrific first step regarding this development. Stephen, Eric, I'm kind of all out of questions on my end. If you would like to add anything at this point regarding, you know, any of the topics we talked about, the next steps, how decision makers could utilize this information, I guess it's just kind of a free-for-all. Stephen, Eric, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, the one thing I would say is that there are two ways decision makers might use this information. One is the status quo, which is to use the differences we've identified to exploit the differences we've identified for political gain. And I'd ask those politicians and those decision makers, how's that working out? We're not able to get anything done, and nobody's happy in this country when we try and exploit differences. I think now we have an opportunity, and I think the only way we're going to get solutions to these problems is by working together. So I really do see, many people see climate change as a constraint on the ability to develop energy resources. I actually see climate change as an opportunity to rethink about and to double down on some of the resources and some of the technologies that Canada has, and that Canada can become a leader in an era of climate change. You know, there are all kinds of things we can do in terms of hydro, in terms of low carbon energy, in terms of carbon capture and storage and carbon dioxide removal. All kinds of opportunities, I think, for this country to benefit economically from climate change within the energy sector. And so, yeah, those are my two points.
Stephen, is there anything you'd like to add regarding this idea of a little bit more of an optimistic perspective? Rather than looking at the differences, we should be looking at the greater consensus of things.
No, I really think in a lot of ways the success of nations in the next 100 years is going to be based in large part on how much they can address these large-scale challenges and costs that are coming forward, and countries that are able to successfully implement a way to address and mitigate carbon emissions and other kinds of GHG emissions, whether with the fossil fuel sector or beyond it in terms of renewables. The countries that do that most successfully are going to be the most successful overall. And Canada has what I would characterize as energy power. It has everything. It has uranium. It has hydro. It has wind. It has solar. It has fossil fuels. And so the real challenge is to create a national vision that moves Canada to the forefront of the energy and environmental and climate change agenda, rather than mixing it up between the provinces. So that's what I would look forward, and I think there are some of the answers in the work that we've been doing here.
Well, I think it's a terrific first step forward regarding this survey work, and I can safely say we look forward to how it develops over time and how it amalgamates into something that will be incredibly useful for energy decision makers, as well as just for Canadians in general. But Eric, Stephen, I just want to thank you so much for your time and being able to talk about the survey work today.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. For more information on the survey work discussed, please visit the Positive Energy website. Today's episode was produced by myself, Ian T.D. Thompson.